Welcome to the Polygamer Podcast, where gaming is for everyone. Join us as we expand the boundaries of the gaming community.
Hello and welcome to September. I hope everybody is having a pleasant fall and is ready to say goodbye to summer. Of course, the fall means new games, especially the holiday releases, are on their way, and I am enjoying Destiny on the PlayStation 4. So far, a good game. You can choose your own avatar, your own main character, male or female, human or non-human. And based on the latest episode of Polygamer, that means that it should appeal to a large audience because they have emotional tie-in and buy-in with their main character, rather than being forced to play a male character that they may not identify with. So good job, Activision. Good job, Bungie. There may be more to the game than I've seen so far, but so far, so good. Before we get into this month's interview, I want to give a heads up on two awesome projects that I discovered just as our latest episode was going to air. The first is AlterConf, a series of three-hour discussions about equality and diversity in gaming being hosted at cities across the country. The first one is right here where I am in Boston on September 15th, 2014, and the second one will be in New York City on October 4th, 2014. If those locations are not convenient for you, you should still check out the website at alterconf.com, where they list a variety of other cities that they hope to expand to in the coming year, including Atlanta, Boulder, Portland, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Toronto, Montreal, and more. This series of talks is hosted by Ash Dryden, who you may have heard interviewed on a recent episode of the Less Than or Equal podcast, which I plugged in our latest episode. And the Boston session is being sponsored in part by Polygamer. The funds that we have donated to this event will go towards speaker fees and also to video equipment so that the talks can be recorded and shared on the internet. From hearing Ash's interview, it sounds like these talks will be going beyond Diversity 101, and there will be some familiar names appearing among the speakers. At the New York event will be Sean Alexander Allen, who was recently on this show, and at the Boston event will be Khadija Marenkov, this week's guest on Polygamer. You'll also be hearing from Maddie Myers, who is on the Isometric podcast, Adri Mills, who runs the Women in Gaming group in Boston, and many, many more. I highly encourage you to check it out. The other event that occurred is Anita Sarkeesian released her latest video. This is the Women as Background Decoration Part 2 in her Tropes vs. Women in Video Game series. You can find it at youtube.com/feministfrequency, or there will be a link in the show notes. Full disclosure, I am a Kickstarter backer for this series. Now, of course, anytime Anita releases a video, the trolls come crawling out of the woodwork, and there's a lot of grief and trolling occurring on the internet, especially toward women in gaming. And the past month has been especially bad for a variety of other incidents that occurred. This collectively has come to be known as Gamergate, and it is not a topic we'll be discussing here on Polygamer. I thought about how we might want to cover it, and I decided that it is just so ugly and so pointless that there isn't anything much original that can be contributed to this discussion. I asked Aline Sims at Less Than or Equal how she was planning on covering it, and she ultimately decided that it really just wasn't worth it. If you do want to hear some intelligent and rational discussion on the subject, I encourage you to check out the Isometric podcast at isometricshow.com. This show is co-hosted by Brianna Wu, who was on my PAX East panel about feminism in gaming, Maddie Myers, a local journalist who I recently mentioned, Steve Lovitz, a talented gamer and Twitter user who you can find at the handle WickedGood, and Georgia Dow, a gamer and psychotherapist. Again, there will be a link in the show notes. Thank you also to Isometric for the shout-out when they were discussing GamerX. They linked to my interview with Matt Kahn, the founder of GamerX. Allow me to pay it forward with a link to James Bartholomew's podcast called Indie Investigations, where they speak with indie game developers, very similar to my own podcast, IndieCider. James recently spoke with Matt Kahn and JJ, who are working on the game Read Only Memories, which was briefly discussed in our own interview on Polygamer. Again, there will be a link to that show in the show notes. With all that said, let me introduce this week's guest. I encountered her when we both gave lightning talks to the Boston Indies group. I immediately saw that this was a topic I wanted to explore further. I followed up with her. Turned out we lived only about 3 miles apart, but we still had the discussion online for ease of recording. We did it again this week via Skype, as opposed to Google Hangouts. And it was one of the first times an interview on this show made me stop and think, I don't know if I agree with this opinion. And that was really encouraging to discover, because it means that I'm putting myself in uncomfortable positions, which is one of the goals of this show, is to stray out of my comfort zone and discover new perspectives that I may not have previously considered, and have to stop and think about it. It also reminds me that there are multiple ways to approach diversity and that there is no one way that can be advocated for on this show or by any individual. Doubtless, as Polygamer progresses, we'll have guests whose opinions on how to achieve diversity and equality differ and may even contradict each other. And whether or not you agree with all or any or none of the guests on this show, it means that you're thinking. So please enjoy this week's talk. I certainly did, and I look forward to hearing from Khadija at AlterConf and beyond. Today, the Polygamer podcast is introducing the world to Khadija Marenkov, a community manager in the indie game scene and also an independent voice actor. Hello, Ka.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
So before we get to talking about equality and diversity, I'm sure everybody listening to the show wants to know a bit more about how to break into voice acting. I, as I imagine many other people, have this fantasy of someday hearing our voices heard in video games, and yet we've never done anything to actually pursue this dream. So how does one get started?
It's so interesting. I've heard different stories, but I can tell you mine, and maybe it'll help someone out. I went to an indie game dev meetup, a local one. And I just went to listen to the talk, and then there was an announcement by the brilliant Jonathan Myers of Reactive Studios. And he said that he was, you know, this was way back before Codename Cygnus was started, I think, where he was like, I'm interested in voice actors who can do different accents. I remember that. And I was like, I'm here. And so I went to talk to him, and I just got my name on the list, and he reached out later, and he was impressed by what he heard on a Skype call that I did with him. And then since then, I've had a pretty good relationship with him. I've been in a couple of episodes of Codename Cygnus now, and then he sort of pimped me out to Lantana Games for Children of Liberty, which was really awesome. So really, it's about meeting that person, answering the calls, I guess, and then keeping up that relationship. Like, I did email him a couple of times, like, hey, I'm still around. How's Codename Cygnus, you know? And that's pretty much how it's been going for me.
And you've since developed a demo reel for anybody else who wants to hear your show?
Yeah, I have. It's on my website, which is under construction still, khadijasvoices.com. There is a link to my demo reel there, which I have up on SoundCloud. And you can take a listen to some of the different voices I can do.
Excellent. Those links will be in the show notes.
Great.
So in addition to your work with voice acting, you also have a master's degree in intercultural and multicultural and diversity studies. Is that right?
Well, it's actually called intercultural relations. It's a degree program at Lesley University. That's correct. Oh, it's just to elaborate on what it is. Intercultural relations, when I entered the program, I was interested in how to better be a bridge between different groups of people. I was really interested in creating understanding through either like interfaith or interracial, interethnic work. I wasn't really sure exactly where I was going to go with it, but I knew that it was definitely something that I needed to study.
So I imagine you went into that without expecting that you want to also break into the games industry.
No, I really did not. I didn't even know that there was an indie game dev scene in the Boston area. I had no idea. I just love games. I always have. And honestly, this is the funny story, is I wanted to make some more friends, so I joined an online dating site, and I honestly, like, just, I met somebody who was in the indie game dev scene, and we're really good friends to this day, and I just ended up going to meetups, and I ended up doing an ethnography on the indie game community here, which is, it's really just opened the doors for me.
And what exactly is an ethnography?
An ethnography is a research study on a group of people, a community. A lot of people think about it as, you know, studying like a tribe from this island or something, you know, but an ethnography can be any group of people. For example, if I decided to study Arab entrepreneurs in the Watertown area, for example, that would be an ethnography.
And that study that you did, that's the paper that you sent me, right?
Yes, that is. It's on gamecareerguide.com now, which was really cool. One of the developers I interviewed strongly requested that I send it over to Gama Sutra, so they saw it and sent it over to their sister site, which is more academic in nature. So yeah, I ended up writing about some of the issues that I saw while observing and interviewing indies in their natural habitat.
So that's actually the context in which we met. We were at a Boston mm-hmm. Indies talk last month, and I gave a talk about my other podcast, IndieCider, and you gave a talk about cultural competency in the yeah. indie game scene. Can you give a brief summary of that talk?
Sure. So what I went forward to talk about was the fact that I felt that there's a lack of understanding about how to portray cultures in video games. I've seen a lot of it happen more in AAA games, but I was beginning to see some kind of shallow, involvement with culture in indies, and I wanted to see something a little bit deeper. So I came forth and started to talk about how we could increase cultural competency, which means to better represent cultures that are not your own. And the some of the things I said were, for example, find someone who's a gatekeeper to that community to actually think very carefully about why you wanted to include that culture and really examine yourself and make sure you weren't being based on stereotypes.
Now, you just used the word gatekeeper, but historically I've known that word to mean very, mm-hmm. Pretentious, exclusive individuals who are trying to keep out these so-called fake geeks. How are you using the mm-hmm. word?
What's so interesting, I love how different, knowledge areas can meet in different circumstances. For me, a gatekeeper is an ethnographical term. It's a tool that you use when you're trying to research. A gatekeeper is actually, from my vocabulary, somebody who is welcoming you to a community, someone who will show you to the right people and to the right places so that you can get a better idea of how that community works. So that's somebody, for example, for me, a really great man, Scott McMillan, was one of my primary gatekeepers to the indie community because of his, he's a veteran of the community. He's still very much involved, and he was at the time organizing one of the bigger meetups. So he really helped me talk to the right people. He gave me the email addresses. He gave me access, told me about different groups, stuff like that. So it's basically completely the opposite. It's being welcoming and warm and open.
Can you give me some examples of some games that could have used that kind of gatekeeper and didn't?
Some games?
Or some games, some companies, some situations where they probably didn't consult someone from the culture they were representing.
Okay. Well, I gave this in my short talk. I'm going to say Prince of Persia is one of them, even from the very beginning. I think that I don't know how well I tried to actually look this up before talking to you and for my own interest. I actually didn't see any involvement of Persian game developers or consultants for Prince of Persia. There's a whole series of games based on, a culture, and a very diverse culture, by the way, and something that's based, in the title of the game, it lists a place, and what we see in them has very little resemblance. Maybe it's sort of a sexified Middle Eastern something or other. But yeah, I think they could have definitely used more insight. I also believe, although I enjoyed what I played of the game, Assassin's Creed 3 with the Native American character, or the half Native American character, and the whole American setting, I believe that there's been a little bit of criticism stating that they were not quite specific enough, and they were a little bit too diluted. Their culture was much too diluted in that game. So I do know that they did a good job on Assassin's Creed 3, but I've heard that they could have done better.
So is that to say that developers can't take certain creative or artistic license when representing these, these cultures in these fictional fantasy games?
It's difficult to talk about, but it's like yes and no. Yes, it is very, when you try to extrapolate from a culture, you can do much more bad than good. Especially if what you're extrapolating from is an extremely generalized place. I'm trying to think of a specific example right now, but I can't think of any right now. But it's sort of like if you wanted to make a game about China, for example, but you based it on very huge stereotypes of Chinese people that are believed here in the US. You extrapolate from there and you might come up with some very imaginative but kind of horrifying things. Whereas if you start from a foundation of truth, of understanding, and you extrapolate from there, I'm sure you can come up with some beautiful things. For example, one game that I know is critically acclaimed, and I haven't heard any criticism of, except for the actors they chose, is Jade Empire, based on a mythology that is not of the developers, but they extrapolated from there and created some very interesting, an interesting world, interesting combat, interesting visual design. All the criticism that I have heard as of yet is that they chose mostly white voice actors, which is another, it's also problematic because you're not including the community in ways where they could literally have a voice, if that makes sense.
But if somebody can do an accent, does it really matter what culture the person comes from as far as voice acting goes?
Mm-hmm. See, that's something that I'm struggling with myself because I can do great accents, but do I have the right to do so? It's a struggle that I have because I don't want to make fun. I want to create something that's more authentic, but at the same time, why couldn't you just hire a person of color who belongs to that group? What, I mean, are they not there? I mean, if it's a question of, you know, resources, I can kind of understand it, but I'm thinking, let's say you're a huge AAA studio and you can hire Megan Fox, but you can't hire an Asian actor who fits that role. I kind of think there's a little bit of laziness going on, if you understand what I mean.
But at the same time, you know, let's say that you're casting a movie and you put it in the description for the cast and for the roles, you know, only white actors need apply because let's say the movie calls for that for some reason. That would be seen as exclusionary. So is it sort of the same problem if you're only saying like only Asian Americans need apply or only Persian actors need apply?
It is not the same situation in my eyes. White people are given the chance to be basically any culture. We've had them play different roles, and yet we do not include actors, even in film, you know, in the places where they should be, we do not include the actors of that culture. I mean, I'm not an expert on casting, but I'll say that better decisions could have been made. Another jab at Prince of Persia is Jake Gyllenhaal as the Prince of Persia. It's so silly. You know they could have done better. You know, they were aiming for the big bucks rather than for something meaningful. And, well, did that film get good ratings? Not really. You know, I'm not trying to tell you that by having that role played by a certain person would make the movie better. I think there's a lot more going on there, but there's just, you're lacking something and you're trying to fool your audience and you're teaching them the wrong things. And I think that people must take responsibility for that. In the end, it's a question of fairness and it's a question of, you know, of truth. And living, I mean, I don't know how to explain this very well, but it's a question of integrity. You know, why not treat your work with integrity?
You said that they're teaching the audience the wrong thing. What sorts of things should they be teaching their audience?
Well, for example, what does that culture have to offer? Are they, you know, for example, it's very easy to label a group of people that look a certain way as good or bad. One example is this new movie, Exodus, that's being made by Ripley Scott. A lot of people are talking about the casting decisions there. The main actors are white. The background actors, the shadier characters are black. What does that teach an audience? It's extremely clear. I mean, if you're trying to tell me it won't affect people of color or it won't affect the way that white people look at people of color, I'm sorry, but it does. It does. It infiltrates our subconscious. That is how we collect information. It's by what we see and what we hear and what we create.
Let's go back to Prince of Persia for a sec. That is obviously a work of fiction. Even, you know, at no point in Persia's history am I aware of magical artifacts with sands of time that rewind and reverse time and the like. So if you're going to have that sort of a fantasy element in there, you know, where do you draw the line of saying you know, this part of the movie needs to be accurate to history. This part does not. I mean, why not just take the whole thing as a work of fiction?
First of all, you're naming a land that exists. So it's not exactly 100% a work of fiction in the way that I'm going to describe it now. Okay. So we base a lot of magic and awesome stuff from the medieval times, for example. There is a layer of authenticity in the way that people live their lives, in the way the characters are portrayed. We kind of have in our knowledge base, we understand how that world works and we extrapolate from there. That has been done much better because it is a mainstream white sort of history that we all know. But when you take the unknown and you take the exotic, and you extrapolate from there based on some shoddily put together stereotypes, we, instead of seeing it for what it is, as being not well put together, we see it as authentic, just like things that are based on medieval England or medieval Europe. That's bad, because the time and effort and knowledge that we have of medieval England or medieval Europe is not as, you know, is more well known than, for example, Persia in the West. And what they, instead of really creating from Persia, they created something fictional with the name Persia. They are associating a land that exists with something fictional. I feel like if they called it something else, maybe, you know, it would be better. I'm not really sure, because there are some very generalized Middle Eastern stereotypes in the games that I feel can be harmful. But I feel like at least they wouldn't have been pretending it was based on anything that existed here.
Because it does make sense. But I think I've heard some developers make the argument in the opposite direction, where they excluded women characters from their, you know, historical war game, because they said at that point in history, women were not on the battlefield. And the gamers came back and said, well, if you're trying to be historically accurate, then you shouldn't have the male warriors attacking orcs and goblins anyway. If you're going to be fantasy, go all the way and include a plethora of characters.
Right. And there's one thing I have to kind of make very clear, is that yes, there is a definite intersectionality of gender, sexuality, and race. There's definitely, like, we could talk about those issues in the same way. Culture is a knowledge base. I see culture as a knowledge base that creates an identity, not gender, which you are born with. It's kind of hard in this situation to talk about them exactly the same way, but let me try. If you think about your audience, okay, and you're trying to create a world and you have no black people in the game, what it says is that you can't be a character in the game. But like, it's different than creating a whole different world that's a knowledge base based on a culture. You know, I don't know how to explain this very well, so we might have to re-edit this part. But it's like, world versus character are two very different things. When you're creating a whole world, a whole set of behaviors, it's very different than the people who look like those people playing those roles. I think I completely agree with the side that says add women in there because there are women gamers. You know, add people of color in there because they are also gamers. But, and you are entering them into a culture that you created, and that culture can't be based on things that are shoddy, on information that is untrue and that is detrimental to a people, because untrue is not nearly as bad as detrimental. We don't want to reinforce negative images of people, and that's what ends up happening, is that there you create misunderstanding with the art that you create. And I think that maybe some developers don't yet understand the effect they have on others globally when you misrepresent a people. you do not misrepresent a people by having different looking people in a culture. You misrepresent a culture when you have the behaviors and the aesthetic and the ritual all wrong, if that makes sense.
When I last saw you, we chatted a little bit about Star Trek. Have you gotten into Deep Space Nine yet?
Not too much, no, unfortunately.
you're missing out. It's probably my favorite Trek series of them all. And one of the later episodes has a scene in the holodeck, which specifically it's like a 1950s era casino and lounge in Las Vegas. And at that point, Captain Sisko, who's an African-American, I believe originally from Louisiana, is invited to be a part of this holodeck scene. And he refuses because he says that in the 1950s, people of his color were not allowed in casinos. And he refuses to participate in a fantasy and thus deny the years of civil rights that his people had to undergo to get the right to go into that casino. And so it's interesting that, you know, we have games that are set in America's history, like Call of Duty or even L.A. Noire, where, you know, if they're trying to be historically accurate, then, you know, Captain Sisko would probably say, you need to have an all-white cast in that kind of game, because otherwise you're denying the battle that this country has undergone to achieve equality.
That's an extremely good point. I think that, you know, this is the thing, though. I think an even bigger problem is that we are romanticizing eras in which people were treated very badly. And I'm not trying to tell you that those stories don't have any merit, but I feel like, you know, I mean, that's such a good point that, you know, he would not want to enter and he would not want to play that game because he did not want to disrespect his people, basically, and probably his family. And I feel like that has a lot of merit because a lot of the situations we choose, like L.A. Noire, things were much rougher for Black people back then than even was depicted in the game. So they were very subtle about that because they probably didn't want to focus on it. L.A. Noire is a game that I actually really enjoyed, and I didn't deem as offensive, but at the same time, I wonder what it would be like to be Black and play that game. You know, I can't speak for that, but I was just thinking that, you know, it is, you know, when you make a game set in an era that glorified white people above all else, I mean, just, it's important for you to also examine why you want to do that too. I mean, there's a lot of people who think it's interesting that there's a lot of role-playing games set in sort of the 20s, the roaring 20s. And a lot of, I actually do know somebody who did not want to play in that LARP because she felt extremely uncomfortable about the way that certain people were treated during that time. But there are plenty of people playing those games today. And why? Because they can ignore the power they have over others and they can ignore the oppression that they put over others. It's a very tricky place. It's a minefield.
Yeah, absolutely. There are certainly no clear-cut answers when addressing issues like these.
That's the bottom line. I wish I could tell you that, oh, you should do X, Y, and Z, and everything will be fine. When that's not the case, everything that you do, you have to question. Everything you do, you have to analyze and examine why. And I think that's cultural competency, is being like, I'm going to think about why I want to do this so much. And I'm going to think about how I can do this with least harm. And that's very difficult. That takes a lot of energy and a lot of time. And I feel like that's why people tend to try and ignore it.
And even when you do try to diversify your game's cast, there are better and worse ways to do it. You mentioned the use of exotic characters in games, but I understand that you find the word exotic to be problematic.
Yes, very problematic. Whether you are raising someone up on a pedestal or putting them under your shoe, a stereotype or a generalization is harmful. The fact that, you know, there are some characters in games that look different than the white whatever ideal, they are either put in there for ridicule or they're put in there as an object, an exotic object. It's the objectification of bodies, and that's very problematic. I see a lot with the, you know, I've done a lot of work on mixed race individuals, and especially those who are half white. and how they are exoticized by the people that they meet unintentionally or intentionally because they have a bit of exotic and a bit of the familiar, especially to white people. But that's not why people exist. People do not exist to be pleasant for you. So yes, I do have a very big problem with that word.
Regarding people who are of two cultures, I will empathize with the story of when I was in grade school playing Dungeons and Dragons, I created a character who was a half elf. Not because I found that to be exotic, but because, you know, as a kid being bullied, I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere, and I wanted a character who I could empathize with. So somebody who's a human has the human community, someone who's an elf has the elf community. A half-elf is sort of ostracized by both, and I wonder if maybe, you know, characters who are sort of at the intersection of two cultures and perhaps as a result existing in neither are something that gamers or the traditional stereotype gamers can empathize with.
I don't know if everyone can empathize with that. I mean, obviously you could, but other people, I mean, I don't know if it's the same in every edition, but the last time I looked at half elves in D&D specifically, they had a charisma bonus for being exceptionally beautiful. And isn't that just a beautiful form of exoticity, of being exotic, of being how that's supposed to be positive? But as you point out, it can be very negative. And I feel like there are a lot of people today living in two worlds, whether they are biracial, multicultural, whatever it is. There are people who live, you know, for me, for example, being half white, half brown. Yes, it is kind of like you are a gatekeeper between two sides, and yet you are neither of the two. And I think that it could be expanded to more of a global message, but it really depends on how, you know, open the audience is and also how good the writer is and how much they can relate to what they're putting forward.
Now, if this next question is too far off the gaming path and too much into political, you're free to pass on it. But I'm wondering, has having had President Obama be such a visible role model in our culture for the last 7 or 8 years, has that helped us, you know, get past some of these roadblocks?
For mixed race people, I don't really think so. I have not perceived, I mean, what I usually hear is not an understanding of what it means to be mixed. It's more, is he black or is he not really black? I mean, it does show that the issue is arising, but most people seem to default that he is black until a certain moment where he does something that someone doesn't like and suddenly he's acting white. I'm not a super political person, but I don't think that people have really understood what struggles he may have, not to put too much benefit of the doubt on him. Yeah, it is a little bit off the mark for me, but I can say that, you know, quite confidently over the years that I've spoken about him to others, that has not been a topic that people show much understanding for.
I think you're right. I don't really hear that come up more often. It's strange. A place that I hear that sort of discussion occur more often is, again, in Star Trek, talking about Mr. Spock. You know, mm-hmm. Is he being true to his Vulcan heritage or right. His human mother? And is that a strength or is it a weakness?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of, you know, Star Trek for me has some of the best writing, has some of the cheesiest things, but has some of the most philosophical questions that I feel like aren't really being asked anymore. And that's such a great example of how he has to feel like he's more or less human or Vulcan. It's very interesting. And I think that that's a good way that people have related to this issue. I don't know how much they've applied it to human beings of our current landscape, but I sure hope some of them do.
And that's something that I feel is missing from the latest two Star Trek movies. I love J.J. Abrams' work. I'm so glad he came along and revitalized that franchise. But the last two films are lacking a lot of the philosophy of what came before.
I completely agree. I was not a very big fan of the first one. I enjoyed it for the popcorn movie it was. But then I watched the next generation through again. And I said, I can't bring myself to watch the second movie. That's literally what happened. Because I realized that, yes, it's not the original series, but there's a depth that, yes, it comes with corniness, but there's a depth to it that is lacking. Star Trek is not action-based. It's not. It's based more on a created world and on excellent dialogue. That's what I believe.
Mm-hmm. And it's showing how humanity can advance past all these petty problems we're having in our current century.
Right. I definitely think so.
All right, so moving on to a slightly different topic, one of the recommended readings you gave me prior to this interview was actually one I'd encountered before, which was Peggy McIntosh's 1989 essay, White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack.
Mm-hmm.
One of the passages in that essay is, "My schooling gave me no training in seeing myself as an oppressor," Peggy wrote. And so I'm wondering, you know, I being a white, straight, cisgendered male, am probably, you know, in the greatest position of privilege that this country affords. Is it necessary for me to see myself as an oppressor?
Is it necessary? Not at every moment in your life, but when you're entering a space where, like, for example, the Boston Indies meetup that we were both at where we met, you walk in and there's very few women and very few people of color. Unfortunately, you can oppress indirectly, unconsciously, and directly. Indirectly sort of means that you have these behaviors that you do, whether or not you know it, that make you an oppressor. You know, acting entitled in line at McDonald's, for example. You don't mean to be an oppressor, but you want to get what you want, and you know you can get what you want. And that's the kind of behavior that you see at a place which is white, male-dominated. You may not think, oh, I'm going to oppress everyone who's not like me, but you do it. And so sometimes, yes, you have to think, am I making everyone uncomfortable? Am I acting very entitled? Am I using my privilege right now to get ahead of everyone else? You can do it on purpose and you can do it by accident. So yes, it is, you will oppress without meaning to. Having said that, everybody has a capacity to oppress. A man who is not white could still be directly or indirectly oppressive towards a woman who's of his same race or a different race, by being in the room and acting like the majordomo without meaning it. He is being oppressive. He is stopping the other person from getting ahead in line or being in the same place. That's literally what oppression is about. It's not necessarily this evil deed that you commit on purpose to everybody. So that's why McIntosh is saying that, you know, I never had to think of myself like that. I never had to put myself in a context. And that's privilege. That is exactly what it is.
Because I'm glad you used the word evil, because when I think of oppressors, I think of tyrants who are mm-hmm. always fearful of uprisings. And if I were to see myself mm-hmm. as an oppressor, you know, one way to resolve that is to not oppress. But the other thing is that it keeps me in mind of potential retaliation. When I see people who I might be oppressing, I think to myself, these people probably hate me because I'm an oppressor. And that is not the way to start a cross-cultural communication.
Mm-hmm, absolutely not. But at the same time, there's a sort of a fear that comes with acceptance. And it's difficult, but you need to work on dissolving the fear that comes with the knowledge that you may be oppressing someone else. When you realize, oh, what I say and what I do affects everybody else, it's more like that's when you start to build the bridge. It may seem very scary, like, oh, but they don't even want to be here. They don't want to be there for me. They're not there for you, but they're someone you can reach out to as long as you realize that you have a leg up over them, you know? And I know it's not nice to think that they hate you or they're upset at your presence, but you can show through your behavior and through listening that you are not there to oppress. There's fear on both sides, and it's legitimate.
I like that idea, that they're as afraid of me as I am of them.
Well, I don't know. Is it necessarily the same? I don't know. Because the truth is that you can be worried about your appearance, but they can be worried about their life. Also remember that.
Right. And I think that's probably one of the bullet points in McIntosh's essay is, you know, I can go to the movies at night and not be afraid of this or that. You know?
Right. Right. And that's the thing. Like, you may, I mean, it's nice to think that your fear is shared and that you can bond on that. But the truth is that their fear may be greater because they have a lot more to lose than you do because you have privilege to fall back on.
In McIntosh's essay, here's another passage she wrote. Mm-hmm. Whites are taught to think of their lives as a morally neutral, normative, and average, also ideal, so that when we work to benefit others, this is seen as work which will allow them to be more like us. Now, I get from a cultural perspective that we don't want to make them more like us and that we should celebrate our differences and our cultural diversity.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, trying to make them more like us in the sense of privilege and equality and access, isn't that what we are trying to achieve? Don't we want everybody to have the same privilege that straight, white, cisgendered males have?
Yes, but let me be real with you.
Please.
In order for equality and equity of peoples to exist, you can't just lift everyone up. It's like saying, I have this big comfy sofa, let's all sit on it. Y'all won't fit. There will be a lot of struggle. There will be a lot of, there are a lot of issues with saying that you can just bring people up. Unfortunately, you're going to have to be brought down a little bit too to make the playing field more equal. So I think that what McIntosh is trying to say is, we can't homogenize culture, but we can't also expect to keep everything that we've always had. You know, you might have to be, for example, the act of saying, I have privilege, I'd better be careful, brings you down a little bit. And that's the kind of action that needs to be taken so that the others can come up. You know, you have to make room. You have to show that some of the privilege that you have, yes, it's not your fault that you're born with it, but that you're willing to let go of it a little bit. I think that's what she's trying to say. And I kind of agree with that because it's not really realistic to say that we can all be kings of the mountain.
Well, that's very interesting because some of the negative reactions I received to the PAX East panel I moderated on sexuality and feminism was that some men find the idea of equality for women in the gaming industry threatening because they think it means less of the pie for them. And my counterargument to that has always been equality is not a zero-sum game. Something that's good for somebody else doesn't necessarily mean it's bad for you. But it kind of sounds like you're saying it is, that equality for others means less for the people who already have it.
I'm trying to think of something a bit more concrete, like, for example, the way racial profiling by the police. You might have to be arrested just as much as a black guy. Will you be able to take that? You kind of have to. Does that make sense? Like, there are some things that you get that you just receive, and you're not going to receive that in the same way anymore if there is equality. So what you're saying is that men won't have shitty games to play just because women are included. I completely agree with that. Okay. But in the larger scale of people and the world, you know, some of the money is going to be distributed. And think about it just like that. Some of the wealth is going to change if people have more equality. Does it mean a worse life for white people? I don't think so. But it means that perhaps they will lose a little bit of that in order to bring some other people up. So I don't know. I don't see it quite as horribly, perhaps, as someone with that amount of privilege does.
Right, because somebody who is in that position of privilege has more to lose, perhaps.
Perhaps, yes. But to other people who do not hold that privilege, well, it's our time. I'm sorry if that sounds really harsh, but...
Well, you do make it sound like an uprising. That I am a tyrant.
I know, right? I just realized how I sounded, and I don't mean to seem like, oh, we're going to take what's ours. But the truth is that we don't necessarily, not we, sorry, but people, minorities, do not have all that we deserve, even in terms of civil rights. Not yet. We're like, I don't know how to explain it very well, but it's very different. It's very difficult to meet those perspectives. I don't want to tell you that you deserve to have nothing. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm really not. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's not the end of the world to lose a little bit to gain so much better for everyone else. Then again, I do come from a very collectivist background. So maybe that's one reason why I'm not that scared of that happening.
So how do you make this proposal palatable to those who are in a position of privilege? How do you advocate for diversity among those who may not see a need for it and may actually find it as threatening? How do you respond to those, you know, those who feel threatened?
First of all, the best work I've ever done is one-on-one. I'm not one, I don't usually speak in front of a lot of groups. I've only started doing that now. But the best I've ever done is given people a space to vent their fear and frustration to me. As someone who is of both worlds, white and not, I hold privilege and I don't have privilege. So I have a different type of ear. I listen to them. I literally just listen to the fears that they have. I have to. They deserve that. And they deserve more. They deserve to hear that what they're going to give up isn't going to look that bad, is in the end going to create stronger relationships between people, is in the end going to create a better future for other people. It's very difficult because I know that there's a self-centered kind of, everyone cares about themselves. Some people care about themselves above others. Some people don't. But it's just what I've had to do when people say to me, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's fair. Honestly, is to give them the time and the space and the discussion that they need. Not everyone is willing to do that. I will definitely try. I'll definitely try to say, but look at how it affects me. At least if they can understand how it affects me, this how this world affects me personally. There's a power in that. People see, well, there are people out there who I could love and have a great relationship with who can't do that with me because of the privilege that I hold. And when you start seeing there's other benefits, that other things that you will gain that will in the end sort of replace those powers that you have. It's very hard to explain. But I hope that you understand, at least, I'm not heartless. I do want the people that I talk to feel safe and secure by the time they leave. And they usually do. Some people will never accept that what they have is detrimental to others. That's the main point, is that when you realize that your privilege hurts others and you don't want to do that, then you already have a motivation to make a better world, a more diverse one.
But that doesn't necessarily mean sacrificing your privilege. It just means using it, I hope, for the betterment of others.
And that's the thing, is that in right now, you can't get rid of privilege. You can't. And that's okay. But yes, it's definitely about using it to help other people. How you do that, though, is coming back to cultural competency. In order to help people, you have to listen to them. You have to use them as the gatekeepers I was talking about. And you have to ask yourself why you want to use them, you know, and make sure that you're not literally just using them. But in the end, you know, using your privilege to benefit others is the best legacy you can leave behind.
Well, I hope that, I know that you said your best work occurs one-on-one. I hope that your new tack toward public speaking and podcasting is also proving effective.
I hope so. I mean, so far I've been getting a lot of positivity. And I'm going to be speaking soon at a couple of places, and it's very exciting. I am a little bit worried, I'm not going to lie, but as much of a challenge as it is, I have to try and reach at least one person.
And one of your upcoming speaking engagements is AlterConf?
That's right. very excited about. That's an evening conference in Boston. I'm going to be speaking about, more specifically, the ethnography that I did. Talk more about how literally what I saw in the community was reflected in the games, and how I believe that diversity of the community could have created more diversity in games from my research.
Excellent. And one other project you've worked on that I want to discuss, which is a slight tangent from everything that's come before, is your Twine adventure called Gin Story. Is that correct?
That's right.
So, yeah, I played this Choose Your Own Adventure title in my web browser, and I couldn't help but wonder how much of it is autobiographical.
Some of it. Not all of it. There are, purposefully, I did not want to include every aspect of my life in there, but there's some things that, you know, the reason that I created it, by the way, was because I went to a talk at Women in Games Boston. And Kaylin Sandel, I hope I'm saying her name right, gave this great talk about the importance of diary games, which is where you create, you know, a game based on your experience. You know, like, you know, she's created some of her own. And I decided that I might as well sit my butt down and complete a game that was based somewhat on my experience, as much as I wanted it to be. And then I realized when I was making it that I wanted to share it. So I did, you know, curate myself and add in aspects of things that were helpful to the story, you know. And yes, it is very much me, even if all the facts aren't there.
And so if this is an empathy game, what is it that you want your audience to empathize with?
There's a couple of things. First of all, empathize with somebody who isn't monoracial, someone who is mixed. That was very important to me. I also wanted people to relate to Muslims. I'm Muslim. I was brought up Muslim. And I just added Islamic themes without over-explaining. I wanted that to be something that was visible. I wanted someone to say, there is a Muslim game out there. And then thirdly, the most important thing is you have an effect on others. The consequences of you manipulating others is great. And I think that that was the most important thing I wanted people to understand.
So in this game, I play as a djinn who is able to influence the life of a child from birth through, in my experience, the mid-20s, and you can choose to be good, evil, or neutral in your influences. I tried to make good or empowering choices whenever I could, and in the end, no matter what choice I made, the main character died.
Yeah.
Is that always the case?
Sort of. The only times when the character does not die is when you don't do anything.
And what sort of moral are you trying to teach there?
The manipulation of others can go completely the wrong way. And that you may think you know an individual enough to influence them positively, but maybe you don't.
So manipulation is not a good thing, but influence is inevitable.
It's true. And you may think that, you know, your influence may not have power, but it does.
Well, great. Now I'm afraid to do anything.
No.
I'm paralyzed. Thank you.
It is a scary thing. And it's a very personal game. And that's the thing, I made it because of events in my own life. I don't expect everyone to feel the same way as me.
As long as they can understand where you're coming from.
Right. It's more about that. And obviously, things are exaggerated in game that are not going to occur in real life, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, we've discussed so many different topics today. I think this is the interview for Polygamer that has probably ranged the farthest from games, and yet it all still ties back in.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you want to bring up? I know you're an expert on a variety of other issues, including body shape and size and how that's represented in games. And that's not a topic I brought up today, because I think it's a topic that warrants an entirely standalone interview.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think that there are people who are also very qualified, much more than me. I'm an activist in that world, but there are people who are much more knowledgeable than me about body size as well. That's another side to this. But I think one thing I want to say is I'd like to leave a little bit of advice for people. You know, I'm not the supreme leader of all things diversity. I'm really not. So one thing that I really want everyone to do is to try and look up people of color's perspectives on any topic that, you know, that they find interesting, be it, you know, race, relations or sexism or whatever, and just read some writing by a person of color. I think that a lot of us take for granted how little we read. So I think that's one thing I'm going to say for game developers out there. Look for game developers of color. Look for them on Twitter. Look for them on Tumblr. Look for them through a Google search and really, really read into what they're saying. You know, really take the time. I think that you could learn a lot from that. I know I have.
Are there any particular resources you recommend, whether it's a Twitter user or a book or a website?
I think the best thing, honestly, is for you to go and look for what you find interesting. One person, I mean, I'm thinking, can't remember his name, it's annoying, but there's always Darius Kazemi, and there's Rami Ismail. That's a couple. There's Manveer Hare, who works for, I know he's working on Mass Effect. And there's a few others I'm sure you can find. Just take a look. They're out there, and they're not that hard to find.
Yeah, Darius is somebody I mentioned in the first episode of this show as having resigned, I think, from the IGDA after an inappropriate party that was held. And
oh, yeah.
I most recently saw him last month at the 7th annual Game Loop in Boston. Mm. And he and I also went to college together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
small
world.
He's a resource.
Yeah, I understand he's starting to step away a bit from games, but I hope that before he does entirely, we can get him either onto this show or something else.
Well, I know that he's just recently written a book about Jagged Alliance 2. So,
That was published by Boss Fight Books, which is a Kickstarter I backed, and I should be getting my copy of that book in the mail shortly.
Oh, awesome. Great. I'm looking forward to getting my copy soon, too. There's just some interesting work out there. Everybody should do more reading. That's another thing. Everyone should read.
Yeah, Zach Wienersmith, who does Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, one of my favorite webcomics, he reads like a book a day because he says he needs to get that much input in order to have ideas for his output.
It's so, and Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal is also one of my favorites too. So immensely entertaining about topics that maybe I wouldn't read about every single day, but it's just, I still relate to them so well. So good job on him. He's so great.
speaking of resources, remind us where we can find you, either your website or your Twitter.
My Twitter is khakhov, Khakov. And my website, which is still under construction, is khadijasvoices.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for spending the last hour chatting with us. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Please feel free to contact me. I appreciate it.
Will do.
This has been Polygamer, a GameBits production. Find more episodes, read our blog, or send feedback at polygamer.net.